Welcome to The Network Break, a Packet Pusher podcast on the latest news from the tech industry with analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Connery Murray, and joining me from across the Atlantic is the inimitable Greg Farrow. Greg, how are you?
I'm alive and kicking it. It's a little bit cold, and there's threatening to do some snow this week, so I'm starting to feel a bit sort of all wintry and sad, really.
It's too bad to hear. It's global warming all the way here on the eastern half of North America, so no snow in sight. This is our first Network Break of 2016, and we're happy to start the new year with a guest, Steven Iveson. Steven's a regular contributor to the Packet Pushers blogs. He's also an author and an IT pro with more than 20 years of experience. And Steven, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Drew. I'm very happy to be here.
Folks may know Steven also from, if you've ever looked at the comments of the Network Break shows, he tends to call Greg and I on our BS.
Yeah, I'm driving home from work most of the time when I'm listening to the show, and I just keep wanting to pull over and take notes.
Good, now you're on the show, you'll find out how hard it is.
Oh, I know.
Shoe is on the other foot.
Yeah, I think you're going to be putting some comments in, aren't you, Greg?
Well, maybe. Yeah, you never know.
Before we get started, I want to thank our sponsor today, Interop. Interop's the leading independent IT conference, and the Packet Pushers are partnering with Interop to put together a two-day Future of Networking Summit. It's going to be May 2nd and 3rd in Las Vegas, and you can go to interop.com for more details, and we'll tell you a little bit more about it in the middle of the show. But now let's jump into the news. A story I pulled up, the Dutch government is saying no to backdoors, and they're also putting a little money into OpenSSL. So, Greg, this is something we've been talking about over the past couple of months. A lot of, especially coming out of the UK and the US, a big push for potential crypto backdoors. Our government seemed to be into it, but the Dutch essentially are saying, maybe not. They put out a paper from the Dutch Ministry of Security and Justice essentially saying, we don't think it's a good idea to make encryption weaker. There are benefits to the economy and to the citizens for being able to use encryption, and backdoors are a bad idea.
This is a real fascinating one, actually, because the Dutch government has basically come out totally against or not in favor of any form of encryption that has backdoors in it, believing that it's correct for citizens to be safe from the government, which is a little different from the US government's position, shall we say.
And the United Kingdom's, I also have to say.
And the United Kingdom's, yes, and a few others. I'm sure that Australia is looking on, thinking as soon as they get it done, we're going to do it ourselves. I do sometimes wonder just how hard this is. There's an article we didn't link to this week, a crypto researcher called Chaum, David Chaum, C-H-A-U-M, and put together a proposal for a crypto scheme which could allow backdoors by governments. It's just literally a proposal, like sketched on a couple of bits of paper, that in theory, there's no actual suggestion that it would actually work. It's going to be interesting to see if that his proposal comes up, because if that theoretically becomes possible, there's a chance that, you know, the governments are going to say, see, it can be done, see, it can be done. But I also read an article today where the politicians in Washington are on their way down to Silicon Valley in next week to meet with the heads of Facebook and Google and so forth and have a big powwow, which is kind of interesting, A, because Washington's not used to going to anybody,
which, <That's right>.
Which might sort of tell you a little bit about the power brokerage that's going on. And this whole backdoors in crypto thing, of course, is the difference between, tech companies need to have total trust from their customers to be able to make their products work. And as I've said before, crypto backdoors might be fine for the US government or for the UK government. But as soon as you do them for the US government, you have to give it to the Chinese government too, if you're Facebook or Google and you want to do business in China, right? Or Chile or Zimbabwe, governments who have no moral grounding and are quite happy to exploit any competitive advantage to prevent dissension inside of their countries, you know, Kazakhstan, those types of places.
Yes.
And where does it stop? And I don't think the US government's quite thought through how difficult the political issues are. So hopefully they'll get a double barrel of that, although the article said basically it's not on the agenda, but I imagine behind closed doors. That's going to be. Perhaps the most interesting part about this is, you'll remember sometime in November I was talking about, we did that article about the banks spending $1.5 billion on security.
Yes, and five banks or four banks spending a combined total, yeah.
And I pointed out that actually, you know, if you really wanted to make security better, you'd be better off investing in open source projects that increase the level of security. Mm-hmm. And so what's the Dutch government done?
They donated over $500,000 to OpenSSL.
Yes, to get better security. And, you know, if I remember rightly from about the middle of last year, it turns out the OpenSSL project was originally one researcher who was living in effectively in poverty because he was doing it for the good of society on less than $30,000 a year. And so it's, this project should be, you know, much better off going forward.
I'm glad you made that connection, Greg, because I was thinking the very same thing. The banks are spending ridiculous amounts of money on solving the cause of the problem. They're trying to treat the symptoms in a fairly selfish way. So, yes, all praise to the Dutch government. I think the other interesting thing as well is, with regards to the Facebook and the Apples of this world, is that there's a bit of a disconnect there in a lot of ways, insofar as private companies hold all this information. And really, you could say that governments are simply asking for the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yet there's obviously a lot of debate, a lot of robust pushback on that. Yet absolutely no one in the wider public sphere seems to think that's an issue.
The fact that it's private companies holding this data?
Yeah. I mean, surely you trust your own government more than a private company.
You know, this is, I actually have thought about this because it is something. The government, of course, worries me. I do also worry about private companies having lots of data about me and my family, because they will manipulate that data, sell that data, use it for their own purposes, use it to make themselves rich. The difference, though, is that Google, as of yet, can't kick down my door, put a black hood over my face, and, you know, extradite me to some secret prison site somewhere on the other side of the globe.
Very true.
No, so, but they could selectively release information to create that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
That's open to abuse. Once the data is collected, the abuse exists in any form. And, you know, and it doesn't have to be Google, the CEO, who makes that possible. It can be compromised elements within the company. Somebody from the NSA or the Chinese government or the Russian KGB could compromise employees in these companies, and potentially even in their own countries. Not necessarily, they don't have to necessarily compromise those people in foreign jurisdictions. So let's say it's the Russians wanted to get access to something, they could compromise Google employees in Russia and make it law that they have to cooperate with the Russian government, which is what the US government is doing, right? It's making it legal. Part of their various legal changes recently has basically made it illegal for US citizens not to comply with directions from the US government, from the Secret Services. And if they do actually get involved with the Secret Services, then they're covered by the Secrets Act. And so they can't actually talk about what they've done. They can't tell their bosses. They can't tell. Uh-huh. So if you refuse to participate on moral grounds, you can actually be compelled under law or be sequestered. So put in jail. In a jail where nobody can talk to you about. That's where we're headed.
The point I was trying to make is Stephen saying we should also be worried about all the information accruing in private companies' hands. But government is also an issue because they have the power to take you away.
Yeah, I do get lost a bit. You know, how much power does Facebook have? And everybody says, oh, well, but Facebook won't last forever. And I'm going like, pretty soon it's going to. But they have their Facebook's introducing free internet in certain third world countries, like Indonesia, for example.
Right. We're trying to.
Yes. And when they say free internet, it means you can access Facebook for free. So Facebook will pay for any data charges to access their network across carrier backbones. Effectively anti-net neutrality type stuff. And it's very valuable to these people because today they have to pay for SMS messages, and the SMS messages cost a fortune. And in fact, the biggest cost of an SMS is not actually the message itself, it's the billing of it. So getting a big wadge of cash from Facebook is much better than trying to sell a million SMS messages. And so it's in the interest of the carriers, and it's in the interest of the people, because free messaging is very good for themselves, you know, family conversations, business, farmers going to market, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a closed system. It's a complete lockout.
Right, which serves Facebook's interests. And let's stick with security. This is a story from Network World about flaws in Comcast's Xfinity home security system. I guess there's some researchers at Rapid7 found ways to essentially spoof these motion sensors that are supposed to tell you if a door or a window opens, that they report all is well, all is well. I found this is interesting, not because of the fact that this kind of thing is exploitable. We've always known that these kind of systems are exploitable, but security is really now moving out of the cyber realm and starting to affect the physical world. And I think as we see more home connection services, more IoT, and especially around cars with automation and cars becoming essentially roving computing platforms, this issue of security is leaking out of the bits world and into the atoms world.
These home systems are having exactly the same problems we have with corporate systems for the last 20 years. That is, common errors in vendor implementations will take 5 years to work themselves out.
Right.
So, you know, over the years, working with companies like Cisco and Juniper and, you know, all those types of companies, they produce a product, but really it takes 5 years before they actually have it finished after they start shipping it, you know?
Well, yes, you as the customer get to be the beta tester, whether you signed up for the beta or not.
Yeah, and of course they hide behind capitalism and say, oh, well, you know, we have to get the product to market as quickly as possible to get customer feedback and make revenue to justify continuing to make the product and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that these products are often faulty from the day they ship. And this is classic sort of things like this. The second part, of course, is these systems require experts to run them quite often. And I'm still looking here, but in this case, I'm looking at the article. The first problem is that motion sensors failed to report motion. Okay, that's a problem. And the second one is, and this is actually shocking, is it uses Zigbee protocol, communicates over 2.4 gig wireless, and if you jam the frequency, it doesn't report anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just stops. I mean, that's schoolboy errors, both of those, right? That's not...
They haven't learned anything. This is Comcast, so they're a big... What are they, television provider?
Television and cable internet, yeah.
Yeah, so they must have a pretty big network, okay? And they're selling this system, and it's basically failing closed for a security system on a house.
Yes.
And would they allow that in their own network?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
If I stop getting contact
from one of my pops in the street, I'll just ignore it because it's just gone off the network, yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be back in a minute, yeah.
Who thought this was a good idea?
Yeah, and the other issue that the article points up is how lax Comcast has been about working to get a fix in place. Rapid7 reached out to Comcast, didn't hear anything, finally had to go over to the U.S. CERT, which does vulnerability reporting and management. So, but I agree with you, Stephen. We know these problems exist. We know how to build secure systems from the ground up, and yet we keep having to relearn these lessons over and over again, and it's really frustrating. One more security story. Let's Encrypt. Greg, we've talked about this a couple of times in the past. It's a public beta. Its goal is to promote, it's a certificate authority spinning up. The idea is that they're making free certificates. If you've got a website, you want to use encryption, here's a free certificate, an easy way to do it. Couple of things. It's public beta. They just issued their first cert last September 2015. According to a tweet that they put out, they've actually reached their 250,000th certificate this January. That's a pretty good uptake.
That's automation. Because literally all you do at a Linux is type a command and you get an SSL certificate issued. And
well, not that it's, you know, hard to do, but the fact that there's an appetite for it, that people are actually coming to the site and grabbing, which is a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely. If I'm running Docker instances or something now and I want to run it as a HTTPS, I'm going to run that as part of my deployment and my testing. So every time I test it, I'm generating a new SSL certificate. So I could see one person generating thousands of certificates really easy as they work through testing their deployment. And if you're generating a cert every time you do a Docker deploy, you could easily generate lots of certificates. That's the power of automation. But, yes, lots of pent-up demand to get SSL certificates out of Let's Encrypt as well.
Yeah, and Stephen, you brought this story to us. So did you have a take on it?
Yeah, I mean, I actually used it myself in early December for a website I set up just as a bit of a test, if nothing else. And yeah, it's very simple, and I just think it's fantastic. You don't even have to register in any way. You do just run a single command at the command line, go through a few steps, and you're there. It's great.
The fee that we used to get charged for SSL certificates was always based on the fact that the SSL certificate authority would validate that you were the legitimate owner of the domain name that the certificate was being issued for.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they don't do that. And what we found more recently is Microsoft and Firefox and Chrome have been auditing the certificate authorities, who've been putting their certificates into our web browsers. And you're now seeing many certificate authorities being removed from the root store because their actual internal processes aren't very good. So the whole thing is that SSL certificates aren't actually very secure. the problem of issuing route certificates isn't very good. So why not just encrypt the traffic flow and be done with it for now? And at least the traffic's encrypted in flight, even if the certificates aren't, you know, totally trustworthy.
Right. The trust issue is always tricky when it comes to certificate authorities. And also another issue that this popped up, there's Trend Micro doing some research, finding out it's not just your friendly local website setting up encrypted traffic. Attackers, malicious users, are also taking advantage of these free certs to encrypt malicious traffic. So there's some research up from Trend Micro. They found a site that serving up malicious ads. The way they did it was they compromised a legitimate server, got space on that server, essentially set up their own little domain within that server, and then are using the certificate to send encrypted malicious traffic to websites. So folks go to the website and then they end up getting malware downloaded on their system. Not to say this is Let's Encrypt's fault necessarily.
No.
Of course, people will always take useful tools and misuse them. It's just interesting that there are legitimate and illegitimate uses for these kind of tools.
Yeah, not at Let's Encrypt fault. And of course, if you're giving away free SSL certificates and they're trusted in people's web browsers, they're going to use that. The thing that was tricky about this attack was they didn't compromise the main website of this bank. They compromised the target, but then they set up a subdomain and then created an SSL certificate for that. They created a server called ad.legitimatedomain.com and then started to stream the malware from that. And of course, that subdomain had nothing to do with the original customer. They should have had better control of their DNS. So it's a multi-factor attack, very well done, and the fact they're using Let's Encrypt is just, so what? And of course, it's going to be abused in the same way that anybody else's Symantec's issued certificates for, like, google.com domain that they don't even have any authority for. So I'm not going to blame Let's Encrypt when the other CAs are doing much, much worse.
Yes, and whoever these people were, they could have gone and bought a certificate and they would have got it.
Yeah, I guess the issue that Trend Micro brought up is that Let's Encrypt may have some issues around revoking certs and if there's malicious use, provable malicious use. And that may be something that Let's Encrypt needs to look at going forward.
Not too many people have OSCP enabled anyway and do actually check for revoked certificates. The vast majority of corporate proxy service, for example, don't do OSCP checking or OSCP stapling even. And because the proxy service, that takes a lot of time and a lot of CPU to run that. So that feature is normally turned off. And I'm not too panicked.
No, definitely not panic. I saw that story and we were talking about Let's Encrypt. I wanted to bring it up.
Just probably worth noting as well, the certificates from Let's Encrypt are only valid for 90 days.
That's right. I did see that on their site.
That's a way of handling the revocation.
Yeah, well, you can imagine how big that CRL is going to be when this really takes off.
Yeah, that's right.
It tends to be 500,000 entries in that CRL file. It's not practical.
Greg, you had brought up something around F5 and doing a product refresh for 2016.
Yeah, I think this is important. We try to get more product information into the network break, but we're still struggling to get information from vendors or locate information from vendors. But I was reading an article somewhere and they just said, it was an financial analyst report, and they pointed out that F5 is predicted to have a hardware product refresh in 2016. I don't know any of the details. I don't know which platforms are being obsoleted. But if you're dealing with F5 and you're about to buy a hardware platform, now's the time to stop and maybe go and check when the new hardware will ship and then pause your purchases if you can and wait to get onto the new hardware platform. Or depending on what your tolerance is for bugs, because no doubt it'll be full of bugs. So maybe you want to get on the old platform before the new stuff ships, according to your appropriate style. Do you know anything about this, Steve?
No, I mean, it was a surprise to me, but I did do a quick bit of research this morning. All I've found out is it's likely to be Q3 or Q4 this year.
Later this year, new hardware platform from F5 predicted to generate new revenue for them. That's the analyst context. Now, the analyst may have been leaking some information, but hey, that's the deal.
Right. Yeah, I don't think they were. I read about it on a transcript from the Q4 earnings call. I'm not sure it's even going to make quite the difference they think it is, considering the push within F5 to move more to a subscription model and cloud-based services. So it's probably not going to have the impact it's had in the past.
Well, this might be a good point to talk about Barracuda. This is a bit further down the list, so I'll drop this in here. Barracuda, who, like F5, produces load balancers, but Barracuda also produces a range of storage gateways, storage appliances, firewalls, and a few other different bits and pieces, mainly targeted at the small to medium-sized market. And they came in with their third quarter revenue right on the guidance, but they're predicting going forward is that revenue in the next quarter will be much lower. And their share price got hit for 16% last night, and maybe it's bounced back by now. But maybe the key thing here is that the president of the company, or the CEO of the company, said, while we see various dynamics impacting billings in each of our markets, so in other words, there's reductions in sales across the board, the shift from traditional and solely on-premises IT to hybrid public cloud and managed services is accelerating faster than we expected and becoming pervasive across more of our markets. So Barracuda is basically saying public cloud is hitting our bottom line. And that would be faster than I had previously thought. And I have a couple of questions here that we should probably discuss here and see if we can get some round table. But you know, is it because small businesses are moving to the cloud faster than big business? So, for example, I know here in the UK, you can't find a real estate agent that actually runs email anymore. They're all on Google Docs and Google Mail. And ask some more businesses, have they just stopped buying IT assets in an uncertain economic climate? So particularly here in the UK and certainly in parts of the US as the economy is in quite dire shape, maybe small businesses are just slowing down their IT purchases as far as they can, and that's starting to knock into IT sales. Wonder what – you have any feeling on that, Steve?
Well, it seems like an obvious trend in some ways, and I'd imagine it would start with the smaller players who are, as in the smaller businesses, who are less likely to have an appetite to want to run their IT, their own IT, and then it's slowly going to move up the stack. But sure, yeah, but even then, I mean, an estate agent, would they, or you know, even someone slightly larger, are they going to have a website they run themselves that they need a load balancer for instance? They're probably not anyway.
Hmm.
So they probably haven't had that ever.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they also have these application gateways, proxy servers, and storage appliances, and a range of other tools. Barracuda is quite, you know, taken Linux and put it on a hardware platform. They've done quite well for quite some time.
Right. They also had a lot of success with anti-spam gateways. But if your organization moves off to Gmail, then that becomes essentially a useless box.
Or Office 365, of course, is the other one.
Yeah. Mm. I'm surprised, actually, to hear the president say this is happening faster than they expected. That seems a little bit short-sighted, given that we've seen the acceleration of software and the deceleration of hardware happening for at least a year.
Yeah, I just feel that if it's happening faster than he expected, then, and this is the first company to say this, then it's an outlying trend and they got caught out, right?
Yeah.
If we see this coming up in the next few, over the next few months, we know, for example, that nearly all the big IT vendors have predicted that the first 3 months in 2016 are going to be slower than last year. There's no growth, right? We know that EMC is cutting headcount and cutting 250 million? They shrank 8% in the last quarter. They're cutting 250 million off the salary. People are being made redundant as we speak. Dell's got some headcount reductions going on. There's a lot of companies predicting that the next 3 months will be a lot of shrinkage. Now, is that because of public cloud, or is that just because it's going to be slow because there's economic things happening? I don't know. I'm just flagging this one up and saying this could be the first of the public cloud impacts. And that way I can point back at it and say, see how clever I am, because you know, picked it out early.
We'll put it on the spreadsheet. It's our first spreadsheet item for 2016.
There you go, in the first show.
Steve, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think everyone's been expecting hardware to go away, hardware sales to slow. But I guess everyone with their focus on that has ignored the fact that even software sales are going to go away and be lost to the large cloud providers.
Potentially, yeah. It's going to hit everybody.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So, for example, you look at AWS and their DynamoDB service, which does automatic snapshots and will actually do database replication between zones. That's a whole market there of products that are just suddenly under attack.
Sorry, I was just going to say, if you had an on-premise F5 load balancer, for instance, and you move to the cloud, Why take it with you? You know, in some cases that would be appropriate because you're using the extended functionality that gives you. But if you're using it in a pretty basic way, why bother?
Yeah, indeed.
So, Steve, you had pulled out a story for us. This is actually a presentation on the website Obesity Crisis.
Yeah, I thought this was quite an interesting one. I mean, it was quite a long article, but it was basically explaining how large web pages have grown over the last few years. And it's quite funny in that it was actually pointing out other articles that were discussing the same issue. And those articles themselves were like, the page is 8 megabytes in size. And they're like, and most of it's advertising. But yeah, I just thought it tied in nicely, you know, to the whole issue with mobile and the fact that there's no money in voice anymore. There's still money in data, and all these websites are just, you know, using up everything you've got in your plan at a pretty high speed. And there was a great example in there of a web page that had some sort of graphic in it, and it was just a spinning globe or something. But for whatever reason, when they left that page open in Google Chrome, it downloaded about 3 gigabytes of data in a case of matter of 2 hours.
Yeah, that's right. It was a Google page on AMP, which is their mobile low bandwidth, and it just continually repeatedly loaded the image over and over and over, and would rack up gigabytes of download over an hour.
Yeah,
and yet the whole purpose of the page is to show how little bandwidth you could use to make something happen.
Yes, and the page might contain no more than 600 actual words of text.
Yes.
But it's 8 meg, 20 meg.
Yeah, Macheka is a very good speaker. It's a talk well worth watching. Put it on 25% boost because he does talk a little slowly. But he is entertaining and interesting to watch.
Yeah, we'll have a link to it. And if you don't want to watch it, he's also got the slides with his comments that you can just scroll.
No, you definitely want to watch it because he's really funny. He's a good speaker.
Okay. there's also a little kind of subtle twist there in that the carriers that you're paying for your data plan are making money from that, and they're also making money from the actual advertising itself by selling the data about you to those advertisers.
Yes, that's right.
So it's like a double dip there.
That's right. The dreaded double dip.
He had a lot of fun sort of getting up everybody, I think. It was pretty good. It was a great tip. Have a watch. Well, I highly recommend it.
I just want to take a second now to thank our sponsor, Interop. I had mentioned at the top of the show that the Packet Pushers are working with Interop to put together a 2-day Future of Networking Summit for Interop Las Vegas 2016. The goal of the summit, we're going to look at current and emerging technologies that are going to affect the networking industry over the next 5 or 10 years. We're bringing in some special guests, some experts and practitioners, and of course you'll have Greg and Ethan on stage to give you their view of the future. We're going to be talking about the changing state of network operations, advances in network hardware and silicon, open networking, SD-WAN, containers, and a whole lot more. We're also going to have a live podcast recordings, and there's going to be an after-hours hangout if you want to meet us in person and some fellow Packet Pushers friends and hang out and have a beer. And besides that, that's just 2 days of the summit. Interop goes over 5 full days. It's got a full slate of independent, top-notch content. You can get great classes and workshops on security, virtualization, IT leadership, SDN, networking, and more. So please make your plans now to join us in Interop Las Vegas, again, May 2nd through the 6th at the beautiful Mandalay Bay. And if you use the code PPUSHERS when you register, you can get 25% off your conference passes. And we hope to see you there.
If you are planning on getting there, one of the things I was thinking about, Drew, is maybe we should get together and do a walk of the show floor. Do a supervised walk and poke fun at all the vendors as we go around. So if you do come along.
I don't know how that would fly,
a supervised walk of the show floor, like, you know, like they do those camera walks. Just struck me. I was thinking about it this morning. I was thinking, like, you know, that vendor's got this problem and that vendor's and that product's not what you're seeing. It'd just be really quite good fun to do like this, you know. No, I'm just joking. We probably shouldn't do
that. The Interop marketing team chases us through the aisles trying to tackle us and shut us up.
If you do come along, there's 2 days of the summit that we're running on the future of networking, and then there's 3 more days of the event where you can actually go to sessions and listen to lots of great talks from independent speakers, not always vendor speakers, and even if they are vendors, it's independent. So it's more than just the 2 days that you're doing with us. There is 3 days of getting access to a show floor where there's lots of vendors, but also sessions, independent sessions, just like you would at any other vendor conference. And to be honest with you, those sessions are pretty fantastic. So it's more than just us.
Yeah, a lot of great content for the whole Interop show. Stephen, you had pulled out Scott Lowe. Folks probably know Scott Lowe if they've been studying virtualization or even listened to some of our shows. He's putting out a new book, Network Programmability and Automation, and this is getting into that whole sort of DevOps, full-stack engineer, silo-busting notion of IT professionals needing to have a little bit of skill across a variety of disciplines.
Yeah, it's not just Scott Lowe. It's Jason Edelman and Matt Oswalt. I'm not sure I said that right.
I believe it's Oswalt, but that's okay.
Yeah. It's going to be a great resource, I'm sure, for everyone out there who's looking to branch out a bit and, as you say, bust a few silos. And I think it's also an indication that the market's maturing somewhat where, dare I say, SDN is concerned, certainly automation and programming. So I think it's a great thing.
What's interesting about this book is that we're still very early in this cycle. Network automation is barely a year old in practical terms, maybe 2 years for some people. So to get a book out is a pretty amazing feat. And the three authors are very well known for long-time efforts in this market. Scott Lowe and Jason and Matt have all been blogging heavily in this network automation space. So I've had a quick scan through the table of contents. I'd love to say I had time to do more reading, but unfortunately not. It looks great. And knowing the three people involved in the book, I would highly recommend it to you.
Open networking is a topic that we talk about all of the time on the show. And Stephen, you pulled out a few bits for us about SNAB.
So SNAB is a operating system which allows you to do very high-performance network packet munging, if you like, on open hardware. So you can just use x86. It's very full of hardware acceleration of the Intel platform. And these articles actually, what they're actually talking about here is open access to network card interfaces. So one of the things that Luke Gorry, who's the author, and there's a really good podcast on SNAB over at IP Space with Ivan, if you're interested in finding out about SNAB. But one of the problems that Luke's been having is getting access to drivers for the network interface card. So if you want to drive a 10 gig NIC at full speed, you really need to use hardware acceleration, even though some of the Intel stuff does help, the DPDK extensions and so forth. And then what they're saying here is there's two things. One is Mellanox has released their API for their XConnect silicon on NICs, which means that he can now develop against it. And the second thing is he started up an open network card that conforms to certain well-known interfaces so that he doesn't have to develop it. And he's named them all on his website. And they're based around the Intel 8259 XL710 FM10K chipsets, which is fantastic. What I want to highlight here, I think, which is really interesting, is that there are many definitions of open. So, for example, Broadcom has had an API. It's been open as long as you've signed a contract and an NDA and you were a Broadcom customer and you were authorized to do it and blah, blah, blah. That's not very open. So truly open is no signing of contracts, published on GitHub, anybody can use it for any purpose, no restrictions, knock yourself out. That's open. Anything less than that is closed. And so this is what's germane here is that Mellanox released the API to their silicon. Off you go.
That's great. I'm afraid the misuse of the term open is now an open barn door that's not going to be closed again.
Open barn door. You had to go there, didn't you?
I did. I had to. And Stephen, you had pulled up something for us about Docker multi-host networking.
I don't think you guys mentioned this last November, I think, when it finally kind of hit production. But up until Docker 1.9, Docker didn't have any built-in overlay networking functions for multi-host communications between containers. But as of 1.9, which I think was released in November last year, it now does have. And I assume the socket plane guys have had quite a bit of involvement in that.
That's a good assumption.
You can. Docker acquired socket plane in the middle of last year. Socket plane has changed their product now to build a pluggable architecture for Docker so that instead of relying on the Linux bridge, you can now have a pluggable architecture and you can run any network plugin that you like. Now, that means you might want to use Weave or a BGP-based vSwitch from Project Calico. You might want to use VMware's Open vSwitch implementation or Cisco's Open vSwitch implementation or Midacura's Open vSwitch or whatever you like, right? There's dozens of different ways of doing networking on Linux, it seems, and there's another one crawling out of the woodwork every other week, Open Contrail, for example. What it means is that Docker itself says you can have any networking plugin you like as long as the networking plugin fits into this pluggable architecture we've created, and that is what's driven the multi-host capability. Once you start using these plugins, you can start to have security zones between the Docker instances on a single host, and they can start to talk to each other instead of just looping out around the NIC on the front. Microsegmentation for the win.
We had been talking about disruption a little bit early in the show around hardware and software, but it also happens to organizations. This is a story coming out of CNET that the Motorola brand is going to be phased out.
I put this article in here because I wanted to do a reminder that big companies die. They don't always survive being disrupted. Motorola was, of course, one of the biggest makers of mobile phones and electronics and they were one of the companies that was, it looked like it was doing really good, and then Google basically bought them in what turned out to be a distress sale. Motorola was broken. Google bought them up. They flogged off bits and pieces of it. They've thrown bits in the bin. They've sold bits, thrown bits of meat to other people and startups and spin outs and all that sort of stuff. And now actually the whole Motorola name is dead. It's just a reminder that your favorite big company can die. They're not too big to fail.
They are not, although it tends to take a long time. These big ones seem to fade over a long period. It's not just kind of snuffed you out.
Yeah, it took, what, 5 years, 7 years for Motorola to fade away? Anything that big, it's like a dinosaur, as I said many times,
it's a dinosaur. Like a dinosaur.
When you cut its head off, it can take weeks to die. And big companies are the same, right? There's these autonomous processes inside them that continue. You know, there's still salespeople out there selling products, even though the company's is sick. So, but I just use that as a reminder. Big companies don't always survive. They do occasionally fail, and it's just a reminder that change is universal.
Yes, we live in a deeply competitive environment, and that's what happens. Last but not least, Happy New Year from Amazon. There's going to be an EC2 price reduction.
Yeah, Amazon claims that it's forever producing price reductions, and this is its 58th price reduction since we've started.
Do they have a little thing like Walmart where the amounts fall down? That would be kind of cool if they could do that.
I think they've announced an API for their pricing, but anyway, neither here nor there. The thing is that it's really small price reductions. It's 5% on their largest and most expensive instances, and smaller reductions for Windows, RHEL, and a few others. I'm not sure that it's, you know, if you reduce like 1% of your stock, is that a price reduction? Or is that like, you know, clearing out old stuff? Or I don't know. Anyway, I just wanted to look at that, and I thought, that's not actually – C4, M4, and R3 instances are really big, heavy, you know, like they're gigabytes of memory and lots of CPUs and stuff like that. That's not – not too many people are actually going to get the benefit of this price reduction.
I thought we had sort of reached the floor of, infrastructure as a service. Is this just – it sounds like maybe this is a little bit more of wiggling on calling something a price reduction. We're not looking at more price-cutting wars going on for 2016.
If I was a nasty person, yes, I'd probably hint at that. But I think in this case, you know, this way they can keep claiming they're doing price reductions. And they probably, you know, they're genuine. It's a 5% reduction in the largest and most expensive Linux instances they make in a limited number of very popular regions. And admittedly, it's in a popular region where people can probably use it, but it's not a huge price reduction. It's not like, you know, 10% across the board. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, compute's going to be free by the end of the year. That's not what's happening here. You know, let's just put it in perspective. This is a really, really tiny price reduction, but it's a price reduction.
Right. So that brings us to the end of another episode of Network Break. Thank you for listening. We hope you have a happy 2016. If you like what we do, please check out our newsletters, Link Propagation and Human Infrastructure. You can find links in the show notes and also on packetpushers.net. I'm Drew Conrimari. You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM. Greg, where can people find you?
People can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters is at etherealmind.
Stephen, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. Where can folks find you?
Thanks for inviting me both. I'm obviously blogging on packetpushers.net, and you can find me on Twitter at @its_network.
Excellent. This has been the Network Break Show. If you like us, please put a like on Facebook. You can visit us on LinkedIn and leave a review on iTunes. Bye-bye.
No virtual donuts today.
I didn't do virtual donuts. I thought maybe I should retire virtual donuts.